Welcome to the sixth season of Better News, the series of special podcasts It's All Journalism is producing in partnership with the American Press Institute. I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. Better News offers strategies and case studies to help transform newsrooms. The effort is fueled by API and the Knight Lenfest Local News Transformation Fund. The goal of this podcast series is to highlight some of the useful research API has published as part of its Better News initiative. If you'd like to learn more about that initiative, visit betternews.org. Tom Lapis is the owner and publisher of the Henrico Citizen. Tom recently wrote a piece for Better News on how he grew reader revenue by focusing on the audience funnel. He's here today to talk about what steps he took to add 9,000 email subscribers and generate $34,000 in reader revenue in 1 year. Tom, welcome to the Better News podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Great to be here.
Okay, so first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. How'd you decide to become a reporter or journalist?
So I was in fifth grade, and the principal of my elementary school put out a call to anybody who was interested potentially in writing for the school paper. She said, you know, come to this meeting we're going to have. I went to the meeting, not exactly sure why. I don't think I had done a lot of writing at that point, but I was interested. Got there, and they said, basically, you know, there are any number of things you could write about if you're interested in it. We'd love to have you write about it. I said, can I write about the 1988 baseball pennant races? And they said, sure, for some reason. So I proceeded to write what I would term a manifesto about Major League Baseball. They printed every word of it. It took up one full page of the four-page school paper that fall, and my career was born.
That's an illustrious way to begin your journalism career. So tell me about the Henrico Citizen. You launched it when you were 24 years old. What were you thinking? What led to you to make the decision that I want to launch this paper?
Yeah, sometimes I wonder what I was thinking, but I had a job. I got a job right out of college here. I went to the University of Richmond as a journalism major and was hired along with a classmate of mine at a family of other Henrico publications, a monthly sort of feel-good publication. And then the owner was starting a twice-a-month community newspaper. So I was hired there about a month before that paper started. So I got to kind of experience what that startup process was like, learn a little bit about all the things that she was doing to make it a reality. And then within about a year or so, I was the editor of both publications and ran them for about a year and a half, 2 years after that, from the coverage side. And so we had a good little team of folks there. I thought we did some really meaningful coverage of the county. And I sort of learned what it looked like to put out a, you know, twice a month community paper. She then was getting ready to move out of state. There was uncertainty about what might happen to the business. And at that point, I wasn't really sure what I should do next. And I was talking with one of my uncles at the time who owned his own small law firm in another state. And he just kind of matter-of-factly said, well, you know, why don't you start your own newspaper? I had never thought about that in a million years. And I never thought I would own a business, run a business, start a business, especially not at that age. And so, but after he asked me that question, I thought, well, you know, why don't I? And so I started doing some figuring and putting some numbers together and asked a few of my coworkers, hey, if I do this, would you be interested in coming with me? Three of them said yes. We kind of set out to make that happen. And I spent about 4 or 5 months planning for a September 2001 launch, not knowing, of course, what we all were about to find out, that September 11th attacks happened. That kind of threw a lot of things into question for the business. But we ended up publishing our first print edition 9 days after that, September 20th, and just kind of making a go of it from that day forward. And we published twice a month in print, all the way through up until the outset of COVID in March of 2020.
So in those early days, how were you financing the Citizen?
Well, it was a combination of things. You know, I had saved up some money myself, and I had a little bit of help from my family. And we did sell some advertising, not nearly enough, but enough, I guess, combined with everything that I could make a go of it for a few years. You know, I look back on that now. I did not hire a salesperson until, I think, my third year, which is kind of crazy. I was naive enough back then to think, hey, if you put out a good product, advertisers will come. People will be interested in it because you have a lot of eyeballs. And that happened a bit, but not nearly to the level that I had hoped. You know, it was a little dicey. I certainly spent a lot of my money trying to get things up and running.
I know in the introduction I mentioned the audience funnel. There may be some people who are not that familiar with that term. How would you describe it in terms of, well, in relationship to the Citizen?
I think the audience funnel is something I, or the reader funnel, something I really was not familiar with until about a year or so ago. We were part of the UNC Table Stakes program through the Knight Foundation, and that's where I really became familiar with it. But essentially, it's just a way of looking at how a reader comes to interact with your publication and to what level. You know, you have a somebody who learns about your publication, they visit your website for the first time, they're sort of entering the funnel. And if you picture like a literal funnel, you know, they're coming in the top of this big opening. And then every reader will progress through that funnel, down through the funnel in a different way and to a different point. Some are going to, you know, sort of get stuck up there in the top of the funnel. They may visit your site once or twice a month and that's it. Others are going to progress a little farther, then they're going to come once a week. And then others are going to go a little farther and they're going to subscribe to your email newsletter. And then they're going to read that a few times a week. And others, you know, will progress farther and then they're going to be reading your email every day and going to your website 4 or 5 days a week. And as they go farther and farther down, some will then become paid supporters or donors or subscribers if you have a subscription model, down all the way to the bottom where people are contributing money, but also encouraging other people to read, to donate, to support, doing some of that work on your behalf. So that's sort of the process through the funnel as I see it and as we look at it. Of course, the goal is to get as many folks down there to the bottom as you can, but realizing also you don't really need, in most cases, a huge percentage of your overall readers to get to that level in order for it to really pay off for you.
Yeah, I know we were talking before we turned on the recording that you mentioned that the Henrico Citizen is no longer a print paper. What led up to that?
When COVID began, we were publishing twice a month in print. We were publishing a few days a week online, I would say. But for the most part, the print product is what sold our advertising. That was where our revenue was. So we focused most of our efforts there. When COVID hit, you know, very quickly, within about 10 days, 14 days, I had lost probably about 90% of my anticipated advertising revenue. Businesses didn't know what was coming next. They all, you know, were kind of worried for their own longevity and pulled out. And I understood it, but it made a very difficult decision at the time, which was, do we fold with basically no revenue to speak of, or do we try to keep going in just a fully digital format? And I picked option number two for a couple of reasons. You know, I felt like number one, there were not really many jobs to be had at that point. Nobody was hiring at the outset of COVID. So I thought if I fold this, I'm probably not going to get another job right away anyway. I'm going to be home for some undetermined period of time, more than likely. So why don't I do what I know how to do, which is write? And I felt like at a time that people really needed a trustworthy source of information locally that, you know, 18 and a half years in, they trusted us. And so I felt like it was our responsibility to help them navigate COVID and school being out and, you know, everything that came along with that in a way that they could trust. And my hope was, you know, hey, if we do a good job for folks or continue to do a good job, it will come back to us in some way, in a positive way from somewhere, you know, that we're going to find the funding that we need to continue one way or another. So that was kind of the approach that we took. And we just dove kind of full into publishing. It really became out of necessity 5 days a week. There was so much happening that we just were constantly producing, you know, new stories.
Tell me about the changes that you made that we sort of talked about, or that I said during the introduction, that allowed you to increase the size of your email list and grow your revenue. You know, what led to that and what steps did you take?
Yeah, I think it started during COVID when we went fully digital, and I had always been torn. I wanted for a couple of years to go digital or potentially fully digital, but I was worried about losing my print advertisers. But I think what we found when we did go digital out of necessity is it was very easy to reach a lot more people very quickly. And so we started gaining new email subscribers just word of mouth, or, you know, people sharing articles, or we had more content than we had ever had before. So people were just inherently finding us. So that helped grow our list by, you know, a couple thousand. I think we were at about 8 or 9,000 maybe at the outset of COVID. And then over the next 3 years, we probably grew to about 12 or 13,000. We started participation in the Table Stakes program late 2022. And that program sort of, you know, encourages you to set a year-long goal and then work backwards to figure out how to meet it in short increments. So one of my objectives was to grow our email subscriber list a bit. And through that program and talking with some folks, a couple of different folks recommended to me this particular program that they said had worked wonders for them. And so we tried it. It's called Opt-in Monster. And basically it was a pop-up ad that would, you know, sit on our site. Didn't look much different to me than other pop-up ads that we had been running ourselves, but where our own ads were getting maybe 5 or 10 new subscribers a week, I started getting 40, 50 new signups a day with this thing. And it was just kind of remarkable to me. And so over the course of 2022, we added almost 8,000 or 9,000 new email subscribers. We are now up to about 23,500. And, you know, it's really been phenomenal for us to see the list grow that much. Now, we serve a large county of, you know, about 336,000 people. So we had some room to grow, but it certainly exceeded my expectations. You know, we've had some stories that have gone kind of locally viral in that time. That helped. We have a partnership with the local CBS television affiliate here in Richmond. So they'll run a few paragraphs of an article of ours and then link to our site. So we're picking up new readers and new subscribers that way. Just a number of things that kind of factored together to help us boost that reader base or that subscriber base.
Were there any steps that you took that, you know, maybe didn't work out the way you thought they would?
I don't think there were a ton. I will say one of the things that we tried to do at the start of our table stakes experience was kind of take stock of our existing readers, which are, again, were about 13,000. And I looked at, you know, how many of those folks were regular readers, which we classified as like 3, 4, or 5-star readers, kind of the rating system that a lot of email programs have, you know, a star. The higher the stars, the more frequent the readership. And I found that about 40 or 41% of our existing readers fell into that group. So pretty regular readers. And at the time, I think we had about 1.7%, 1.8% of that list were folks who were also donating to us financially. And I figured out that the average donor was giving like $55 a piece. So I thought, all right, if we can add more email subscribers and we do nothing else, and these numbers translate, you know, we're going to continue to grow our revenue base from readership, even if it remains at a 1.8% kind of level. And as we have added subscribers, those numbers have relatively held true. And so, you know, we have found that I now know that about for every 100 email subscribers I get, about 40 to 42 of them are going to become regular readers, and probably 2 to 3 to 4 of them are going to become donors. And now the average donor is giving close to $65 a year. So I have been able to kind of figure out exactly what I can expect for every 100 new subscribers that we add. So as far as things that haven't gone exactly according to plan, you know, those numbers are not exact throughout the process, but I think that gave me a sense of, okay, now I can start to budget for this. And now I can look at what is necessary, you know, from a financial standpoint, what is it that I'm looking to achieve? Am I looking to fund more freelance opportunities, a full-time position for someone, you know, and I can kind of look at these readership numbers and say, all right, this is what I need to do to get to that level.
Did your audience notice any change? Did you ever get sort of a reaction from them about, you know, the way you were growing your audience?
I don't think we saw much in the way of pushback. You know, my fear was anytime you put a pop-up on your website, you feel like, okay, that's going to be intrusive. People are going to get annoyed by it, especially when it's the same thing all the time. But we have had a total of probably 15,000 email addresses from folks who have signed up over the last 14, 15 months. Some of them are duplicates. And, you know, through churn, we've lost a few thousand folks. So, but we've had that net gain of more than 10,000. And in that time, I've probably gotten 4 people who have complained to me about the pop-up. So, you know, hardly anyone notices it or cares. And I think we're all just kind of used to certain levels of pop-ups maybe. But from that perspective, there's really been no pushback. You know, one of the other things that we've done is I really made a concerted effort to make the ask, to ask people to donate. And I think last year I sent out something like 40 separate emails to that effect to our subscriber base, asking them to give money to us. And that's another thing that I think a lot of us in the industry have been fearful of. We're afraid to overdo it. We feel like maybe we ask them once or twice a quarter, that's too much, you know. I was really encouraged by folks in the table stakes program to ask and ask and ask and ask. and it's worked. I mean, I now know, again, I've sort of tracked every email that I sent over the last 12 months to see how it performed. How many donations did we get? What level of giving? You know, what's the total take from each email? What worked? What didn't work? And so there have been some trends that I've learned. I've learned about certain subject lines that got a better response. I've learned about certain times of day, certain days of the week to send the email that get a better response, and a certain tone, I think, that works. You know, for us, it's been more a casual tone. Sometimes I try to be humorous. Sometimes I'll just be real honest with people, not too buttoned up, you know, just sort of saying, hey, if you care about your community, we think we contribute to it. We think it's important for people to know what's happening. We really appreciate your support. And so that's been really beneficial.
Appeals like that seem to do well. People react to those. But, you know, I understand your hesitancy to do certain things. I think if you look back in the long term of, you know, digital journalism, there used to be this big divide between the sales side of the business and the journalism side as the, you know, the revenue started to slip away. And, you know, we weren't necessarily replacing those people who were going out and selling ads or promoting you. A lot of the revenue solutions at the beginning were kind of like journalist solutions. We'll just write more content. But you need somebody to think that way, which is perceptive by yourself that you hired somebody after 3 years that, yeah, hey, we maybe need somebody to think about this. So tell me a little bit about the Citizen has a 15-member citizen advisory board. What is that? How'd you set that up and what does it do?
Yeah, that was another piece that came together, I guess, in 2021. And again, just kind of listening to what some other folks in the industry had done, I really liked the idea because I think what it was trying to do was to give voice to folks who maybe had been historically underrepresented in media in general, but also it was recognizing a shift in how we operate, hopefully all of us, in the sense of, you know, for many years, I think it was sort of, you know, we're telling you what we think you should care about, reader. You know, we're going to write about what we think is important to you and you're going to read it. What this tries to do is to recognize like, hey, there's a lot of things happening out there in our community that we may not know about, number one, but also that are, number two, important to people and that they really sort of, the way that I've put it is this is what they require of us as their local publication is to cover some of these things that matter to them. We don't know always what those are unless we ask. We'll never know what they are unless we ask. And so this board is our attempt to kind of find out at the grassroots level, hey, what is it that matters to people? What do people care about? What do they want from us? And also, do they have questions about why we cover this but not that? Or how can we bridge that gap of trust maybe with the community? So we were very intentional. We just seated our third board in 4 years earlier this month, had our first meeting at the beginning of this month. And, you know, we've tried to pick a board each time that reflects the racial background or the racial makeup of our county that includes a wide variety of folks, different ages, again, different backgrounds, different jobs. Some are retired, some are working. We've had a police officer, a firefighter, attorneys, you know, executive directors of nonprofits, nurses, just all over the place because everybody brings a different perspective. They all are connected to different circles of influence. Many of them are volunteers within the community. So they reach a lot of people. And so what we've kind of tasked them with in the years that we've done this is, hey, go to the groups of people that you are connected with and share information about the Citizen, but also sort of collect information from them that you can share with us that may help us decide like, hey, there's some things here that we need to be covering or there are different opportunities that we might have to reach people in a new way. And so I think it's been very valuable to us. It continues to grow. You know, we're learning what works and maybe what doesn't, but it's been a really good, fun process.
It sounds really smart. It sounds like something that gives the community and the people who serve on the board a sense that they're a part of the decision process, that they can find that voice. Those people who didn't have that voice before, they're able to engage in that conversation. I think it's really smart. So what does the 2024 Citizen look like compared to the 2020 version? What things have changed?
Well, a few. I mean, we were fortunate in 2021, we applied. So after COVID, we learned how much people cared about education here. And I don't think that's necessarily unique to Henrico, but it was a real emphasis. You know, we've had one of the top school systems in the state for many years. And so people just really cared about education. And so we applied to Report for America for a full-time education reporter's position. We were accepted and we became the second newsroom in our state to join that program. So we were able to hire a full-time education reporter in the summer of 2022, I think. And so that really allowed us to kind of take our coverage to the next level and show people like, hey, with a little more funding, an RFA helps pay for that position. So it was a position we could not have afforded on our own. But we were able to show people like, look, this is what happens when we're actually able to afford a high level reporter. And the readership increased. Most of our most read articles in that year were education pieces. We were able to really do a much deeper dive into that stuff. So we're still part of the program. We have our second RFA reporter on the education beat now after our first one moved on. That's just really been, I think, a shift, is that we're able to compete on a higher level, I think. And also, you know, we are, again, we're 5 days a week now. Before COVID, we were essentially twice a month with a few pieces here and there that would be posted online. Now we are a 5 day a week news organization. And so I feel like we are competing successfully with every other, you know, local news organization in Metro Richmond that covers Henrico. And we've really developed a much stronger following since we went fully digital for all the reasons I've kind of mentioned before. But I feel like people look to us first now if there's something happening in Henrico that they want to know about and understand, and maybe at a deeper level than they would get from, you know, television or someone else that might cover it sort of superficially. I also feel like from a financial standpoint, certainly we are much in a much better space than we were right after COVID. We've really worked to diversify our funding. I mean, we still have a lot of room for growth, I think, in the advertising sector, but, you know, we've gotten a few grants. I mentioned the Facebook grant that we got a few years ago. We just earned another grant, a $30,000 grant from the Chronicle of Philanthropy to cover refugees and immigrants in our county, kind of through the eyes of nonprofits that work with them. Reader revenue, obviously, is now a big part of our budgeting process, and we're up to like 620 donors in the last 12 months. My goal is 1,000 by the end of the year. We'll see if we get there. But if we do, you know, that would be probably $60,000 of reader revenue that we could potentially hire a full-time reporter with and have some other money left over for other purposes. So I think just, you know, we're trying to work. We've got a good sponsorship partnership with the county's Economic Development Authority that has helped us provide some free advertising to 20 local small businesses here. So just a lot of different ways that we have now positioned ourselves to be more sustainable. We're not there yet where we really need to be, but we're getting a lot closer.
Coincidentally, the governor just signed a bill that allows digital-only publications to run announcements.
That's right. Yeah, I was part of a group of four publishers in the state that sort of worked with the Virginia Press Association to get this bill written and ultimately passed pretty easily with a lot of bipartisan support. And Virginia is now going to become the first state in the nation that will allow legal notices on an online-only site. So we're really excited about that. I think more than anything from the position of, you know, if the purpose of a legal notice is for people in the affected locality to see it, to read it, that the law really in every state was outdated because just so many people are now getting their news online only. And so we're hoping that this will be not only good for Virginia and good for the citizens here and hopefully will help us, but will also become the framework and a template for other states to replicate it, you know, and pass similar laws.
It's not necessarily going to sustain you, but it's revenue that you can sort of count on, but it also makes you a destination for that type of information.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's fair. It just becomes another little maybe bucket of revenue that we can use to continue supporting our community. And when you're budgeting for things, especially when you're small, every little bit helps. And so, yeah, knowing that there's going to be some kind of consistent revenue, whatever it is, will help us continue to serve, you know, our county.
So what advice would you have for other publishers who want to grow their email list and increase their reader revenue?
Well, you know, for us, I think the email list was so key. A lot of publishers, I think, have focused on social media growth over the years, and every market is different. Every publication is different. So I'll never say this is great or this is awful. But for us, I think the email list has been so important because it's direct communication to our readers. We don't have to worry about, you know, is Facebook going to devalue news? Is Twitter going to collapse? Like, we kind of use social media, and really we have for the last couple of years, as anything we get from there is bonus. It's great. We post on there a lot, but we don't spend any money promoting anything on social media. So we're going to get some readers from there. That's great. If we don't get many, okay. We've got 23,000 people getting our email every day. That's a direct communication from us to them. So, you know, I can only, I guess, give advice on what I know, but this program that we used really helped generate a lot of signups. I think however you have to promote your email newsletter, I think it's wise to do it, because then again, you're getting those addresses that are yours. And you don't have to go through a third party to try to reach people. you can just send that email out and, you know, and you're reaching them. I think it's important to survey your readers and find out. We do this probably once or twice a year. Like, I'll send out an email that just says, tell us what to cover. You know, here's a quick link to a page on our site where you can fill out a form and give me a story idea. Even if people don't fill that out, and we do get a couple hundred emails back every time we ask that. But I think it just shows people that you're working for them. You know, our focus has been on community. Like, we are here to serve the community. How can we do that? Let us know. And I think that helps grow engagement. And, you know, I mean, we've been here a long time. So we, all of us on staff, have a lot of personal connections. And when I look at our donor list, there are a lot of names that I recognize because they're people who know me or who know our managing editor or know our social media manager. And I think that matters. So the connections that you build in a community will help. And those people will say, you know, I had a great interaction with Tom, and they'll tell somebody, hey, you got to reach out to the citizen about this or that or the other thing. And there is a snowball effect that can come from that. It may take a little while at times, but that's real. But, you know, I think the key is then once you have that base of email subscribers, however big it is, that you make the ask and you just put it out there, you know, explain to people what you're trying to do. What are your goals? Why are you doing this? What's your vision for the community? What's your vision for your publication? And how can they help? I think a lot of times we're worried about the negative feedback that we're going to get from people asking for money a lot or, you know, any of that stuff. But in reality, there are a lot of people out there who are supporters, you know? And so think about the positive side of it. Like, they may be waiting for you to reach out to invite them to participate, to donate. I've got, you know, personal friends of mine who have told me on many occasions, hey, I didn't get that renewal email from you. I've just been waiting to get it. And I'm thinking, well, you could just go on to our site and make a contribution anytime, but they would rather hear from me directly with a request. And so kind of flip that fear and turn it into something positive where you're saying, hey, it's, you know, I owe it to these people who want to support us to reach out and ask. And don't be afraid to ask a lot. I mean, like I said, I might email somebody 50 times. They're getting all 50 of those emails, and it's the 50th time before they donate sometimes. I don't know what hit them that particular day. Something did, and now they gave me $100, you know, and now I can go back to them next time and say, hey, you know, we appreciate your support, time to renew, you know, whatever. And you just sort of are building that base of customers. And again, you're getting folks down farther into the funnel where they're becoming supporters and really champions of the work that you do.
I'm Michael O'Connell, host of the Better News Podcast. I've been talking to Tom Lapis of the Henrico Citizen about how he grew reader revenue and increased newsletter subscriptions. Tom, thanks for coming on the Better News Podcast.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Better News, a co-production of the American Press Institute and It's All Journalism. API's Better News Initiative offers strategies and case studies to help transform newsrooms. You can find out more about the Better News Initiative and this podcast at betternews.org.